My colleague at McCormick has a few years' service on me, and so he gets to teach the course in biblical archaeology or archaeology of Syria, Palestine, and the Bible. If I ever get to teach course, maybe I'll do it next time he goes on leave. I think I would entitle it Archaeology and the Bible, Proof or Improvement. There's been a lot written on the subject of archaeology as supporting the historical memory of the biblical material. Some of you will have read Werner Keller's The Bible as History, which was a bestseller in the States back when I was in school, I guess, in graduate school, a quarter of a century ago. Keller did a lot to popularize what a number of archaeologists had talked about as the amazing historical memory of the biblical material. For my part, I like better another sense of the word proof, and that is the sense in which my teacher, W.F. Albright, was fond of saying that archaeology proves the Bible in the sense of the old adage that the proof, according to which the proof of the pudding is in the eating. In that adage, of course, the word proof means test. The test. So archaeology tests the Bible, and having spent the better part of the last 20 years producing these two volumes by my favorite author, the books of Joshua and Judges, when David asked me to prepare a course while I was here, that seemed to be the thing that I would be best prepared to do, especially as my reason for being here, the research project, which I have blocked out for this year, is another look at the biblical stories pertaining to the emergence of ancient Israel, or ancient Israel's claims to possession of territory on this side of the river. Those are the stories which are not recounted in the books of Joshua and Judges, but in the book of, especially in the book of Numbers, although there are some echoes in the books of Joshua and Judges. So that's what I'm here to do this year, is to collect as extensively and as thoroughly as I can the evidence that has been forthcoming from a battery of surveys and excavations that have been conducted in Jordan over the past 10 to 15 years, with an abundance of data that simply was not available 10, 15 years ago, and which ought to make it possible now to restudy the biblical traditions pertaining to this side of the river. Once all that data, which most of which is still unpublished, but I trust available in reports, most of it in reports to the Department of Antiquities, which I hope to consult during the 9 months that I'm here. So for these 6 weeks, the focus on archaeology and the pre-monarchical period, what we call the pre-monarchical period in ancient Israel. I have some handouts. Where did Laura disappear to? I have only 10 of each. Let me give you the originals then. And again, I'll start. These can either start around. One is a map, which with wide margins, which you can use for note taking if you feel so inclined. And the second is a chronology of the biblical period, with the major archaeological periods bracketed in the left-hand margin. And the third one is an excerpt from the chronology of the ancient world that we find in John Bright's History of Israel. And I have drawn it's not a circle, I don't know how to describe that shape, which I have drawn around the pertinent segment of the chronology of Syria-Palestine in the first column and Egypt, especially in the second column, which pertains to our two books, Joshua and Judges. The biblical traditions which we will be dealing with are Middle Bronze, Late Bronze, and Iron Age traditions. There seems to be very little, if any, memory of the preceding Early Bronze period, the centuries of the 3rd millennium B.C., in the stories that came to be collected together in the book of Genesis, the period of the so-called patriarchal period. Although so many of you may have been reading in recent years of the discoveries made at Tel Mardik in Syria, about midway between Damascus and Aleppo, the site of ancient Ebla. You may have been hearing and reading about speculations concerning the origins of some of the patriarchal material, the patriarchal stories in Genesis 12 through 50, in that late EB setting. But it is clear in any case whether or not those claims stand up over the long haul. It is clear that in any case with the material in Joshua and Judges, which the books which present the account of the stories of the Israelite, ancient Israelite takeover of the land east and west of the river, that's the book of Joshua, and the book of Judges, which contains a collection of stories stemming from the 13th and 12th centuries, or 12th and 11th centuries B.C., in other words, the period known or conveniently referred to as the pre-monarchy period in ancient Israel. In those two books, we are dealing with traditions which stem from probably late in the Middle Bronze Age period, the Late Bronze period, and the Iron Age. And so I hope that these chronology charts will be helpful. So let's look first at this one that has this heading, the authors of that eminent and profound history of Great Britain entitled 1066 and all that, were able to reduce to one the number of fixed dates that every educated Briton needed to know to show his erudition in history. This is prepared for my students at the seminary. No such luck. You need at least these pegs securely in your memory. Let's skip down to the end of the Middle Bronze Age, or the latter part of the Middle Bronze Age, that's indicated there, 1710 to 1550, the period in which foreign dynasties, non-native dynasties, were in power in Egypt, the so-called Hyksos, and period in which the what I like to refer to as the narrow corridor between the desert and the sea, Palestine and Jordan, was throughout that period rather firmly in control of local kings reigning in a number of small city-states on either side of the Jordan River, but very much subject to the power of Pharaoh and to Egyptian administration. That period comes to an end, however, in the 16th century, when powerful native Egyptian dynasty kings are in power once again and are have reclaimed the throne of Egypt for themselves and are rapidly campaigning year after year in the corridor to the north, reclaiming for themselves those city-states. And that is the end of the Middle Bronze Age period, the beginning of the Late Bronze Age. In the 14th century, 1400 to 1350, as indicated on the handout here, we enter the so-called Amarna period, in which the a religious revolution has taken place under the auspices of native Egyptian dynasties, a native Egyptian dynasty which has moved the center of government far up the river, away from the old Hyksos capital, which had been in the Delta region. And it is from this period that the famous Amarna letters have come to us, cuneiform tablets which were excavated in the last, last decade of the last century at Tell el-Amarna, the capital of Egypt in this period. And these tablets represent the diplomatic correspondence between the Home Office there at Thebes and these vassal kings governing in Palestine and Syria, and even diplomatic correspondence from as far away as the as Asia Minor, the Hittite Empire, and Mitanni, the empire, the neighboring empire to the Hittites in northern Mesopotamia. And it is in this period that, and from those Amarna letters, that we have evidence of rather serious breakdown in the Egyptian administration of the far-flung northern reaches, and not so far-flung, northern reaches of the empire. Many references in these letters to the activities of people who are referred to as Habiru, or sometimes transcribed Apiru, depending upon whether or not the scribe was intending to represent Egyptian spelling or cuneiform spelling, as I understand it. In any case, this word, these Hapiru, are causing all sorts of trouble for the local dynasts scattered up and down the land on both sides of the river. So much so that the term Hapiru or Apiru in these letters acquires a pejorative use. It appears that the Hapiru are in any case peoples who exist at the fringes of society. They are fit subjects for the forced labor battalion. They are often found hiring themselves out as mercenary soldiers. they enter into various relationships with the local dynasts up and down the corridor in such a way that the writer of one of these letters can write home to his king, to his overlord in Egypt, requesting additional troops in order to deal with the unrest that is being stirred up by these Apiru. They can make accusations concerning their colleagues in other city-states that they have gone over to the APIRU, or that the city is in league with the APIRU. Who are these APIRU or HABIRU? The word is can be equated with the word Ivri, which we have in the Hebrew Bible. In other words, Hebrew. These seem to be two ways of spelling the same word. And so when these Amora letters first appeared and were deciphered and translated, many people thought that we had at last direct extra-biblical references to the biblical Hebrews. It's very interesting that that term Hebrew is only rarely used in the Old Testament material. Only about somewhere between 32 and 35 occurrences of the word with this social reference. It occurs as the label of a language, as a word, as the name of a language, a great many times, but with reference to a people. Less than 35 occurrences, and they're concentrated in the books of Genesis, Exodus, especially Exodus, and 1 Samuel. It is very interesting that once this organization called Israel becomes a highly centralized nation-state governed by divine rights and monarchs beginning in the 10th century B.C., that term Hebrew drops out of use by the biblical writers, and they no longer refer to their own people as Hebrews. This is very suggestive. It suggests to me that there is some connection between this social class to which we have numerous references, not only in the Amarna period, that's where we have the greatest cluster of them, but we have references to the uses of this word in extra-biblical material from centuries preceding the Amarna period, and from wide-ranging variety of sources. But the distribution of this word, use of this word Hebrew in the Hebrew Bible, the fact that it practically goes out of use from the 10th century on, suggests that there may very well be some connection between that larger social class called Habiru in the extra-biblical documents, who were such troublemakers for the existing political alignments, and the fact that the Israelites, prior to especially David's consolidation of central authority, referred to themselves as Hebrews. But I'm getting far ahead of myself, but that always happens in my lectures. Once the Israelites are citizens of a nation state, they are by definition no longer Hebrews, and the word goes out of use. So I think that there must have been some connection between that social class known as the Hapirim and these early Israelites, many of whom, in other words, were also at one time Habiru. But once the tribal confederation, loosely aligned tribal confederation, had given way to a highly centralized nation state, the social status of an Israelite had changed. The next thing on the chronology here is approximately 1280 with a question mark, the Exodus. Here I am following, this chronology is simply following one which has been widely accepted among critical scholars over the past several decades. About 1280 for the Exodus event puts that in the reign of the long and powerful reign of Ramses II, who was busily relocating the Egyptian capital, rebuilding the Egyptian capital at the site of the old Hyksos capital in the Nile Delta, and making extensive use of non-Egyptian forced labor. We may be quite sure. So Ramses II has for a long time been nominated as the most likely candidate for the pharaoh who arose, who knew not Joseph, and under whose reign the situation of Hebrews there in the Nile Delta, or Hapiru, though their situation changed drastically. The reason that the Exodus was placed by Albright and many others early in the reign of Ramses II is that the earliest extra-biblical reference that we have to Israel is in a victory statement of Pharaoh Merneptah. The dates you'll find on the other chronology sheet, excerpted from John Bright. There he spelled it Marnipta, just below the 1250 entry. Bright's dates were 1224 to, Bright's dates for Merneptah were 1224 to 1211. I've scratched that out and written in 1212 to 1202. This is the latest refinement of the chronology coming out of the Oral Institute at the University of Chicago. And I don't know what that adjustment, Jake, does to the reign of Ramses II. But this is, and it's being widely accepted now. So that the fifth year of Merneptah would be about 1207 BC, in which year he erected a memorial stele celebrating last winter's campaign in the corridor, among whom and among the cities and peoples who were listed there as having been conquered or in one way or another pacified on last winter's campaign is a reference to Israel. So that's the earliest extra-biblical reference that we have to Israel in surviving materials. And Albright and those who followed him and others working independently were assuming that the reference to Israel in Merneptah's stele means a reference to the post-Exodus, post-Moses group. In other words, the Exodus had long since transpired. The period that is represented in the tradition by a claim of 40 years of wandering in the wilderness would also be in the past and conquest. I put a question mark after that date for reasons which I hope will make sense as we get into the material later on. Conquest on that older chronology then fell in the last decades. I've indicated here roughly 1240 to 1200. In any case, it is the Exodus and conquest have happened by about 1200 BC. And so the centuries of 1200 to 1100 BC represent the what we call the pre-monarchy period in the history of the biblical people, in which Israel was a tribal organization. In the canonical version of the tradition, the main storyline has it, an organization of 12 tribes scattered throughout the land on both sides of the river. 9 1/2 tribes to the west of the river, 2 1/2 tribes to the east of the river. So, let me ask if at this point if there are questions. Please, if at any point I'm not making sense, interrupt and ask for clarification, because I do not want to speak continuously for an hour and a half, and you don't want to listen to me continuously for an hour and a half.
Out of curiosity,
well,
why should one tribe have been half and half, and which one wasn't?
It's the tribe of Manasseh. And a good question is why it should be half and half. Now, there is a good question, that is a good question as to why it should be half and half.
Is there a good answer?
Actually, is it? 10 and a half and 2 and a half. Right, because Manasseh is on both sides of the river, and Levi is scattered throughout all of them. We'll get into that. I think that the thing we should do next, however, is proceed with the short course in historical geography. The short course in historical geography ought to take half an hour, or 40 minutes at most. Lauren, would you turn on the machine? I've got more.
Yeah, it looks like that.
Oh, I'm sorry. You have to turn it in and plug it into the transformer. Simply a map of the Eastern Mediterranean. Everybody knows where we are. Here in the corridor, the Sinai Peninsula, the Nile Delta, as seen from the satellite, the Arabian Peninsula, the narrow Sinai Peninsula here, and a closer satellite view of the area in which all of this happened. A very narrow corridor between the desert and the sea, the Sea of Galilee, in the far north. The Jordan River Rift, the Dead Sea, and the continuation of that rift, known as the Arabah. It's the Asiatic extension of the Great Rift Valley, which continues on into East Africa, as I'm sure you know. Here is the topographical map, which will make it clearer why I think that historical geography is so helpful in our approach to these traditions. As you know, the land is characterized by these long north-south divisions, the major one being this long geological fault line, creating a high mountain ridge which runs almost the entirety of Cisjordan, or western Palestine, interrupted only at one point, and that is here where the Mount Carmel Spur, indicated on your map, runs out to the port of modern Haifa, ancient Acco, separating the high Galilee mountains in the north from the hill country of was largely the tribes of Ephraim and Judah in the ancient land division here to the south, until the hill country gives way and you come out onto the area of the Negev Desert. Pardon?
Before you go on, or yeah, before you change the thing, finish and then I'll ask before you.
Yeah, okay. As you know, from your experience of this side of the river, the transitions in terrain are remarkable, with the vegetation patterns, because of the prevailing winds off of the Mediterranean year-round, the most of the moisture falls on the western slopes and on the western side of the Jordan Rift, so that the backside, the eastern side of the western hill, of the Cistern hill country, is in the rain shadow. So our major divisions west of the river from north to south are Galilee in the far north, where the highest part of the country west of the river, where the mountains rise to something a little more than 3,500 feet above sea level. But already at the Sea of Galilee, you're almost 700 feet below sea level, if I remember rightly. And at the surface of the Dead Sea, we're almost 1,200 feet below sea level. Maybe 25 miles as the crow flies from the port of Acre to Galilee, maybe 40 miles from Jaffa on the coast to Jerusalem, atop the central hill country ridge. These Galilee mountains are interrupted by this broad plain of Esdraelon, or the valley of Jezreel, where the Mount Carmel spur juts out to the coast. Okay, down here in the vicinity of Hebron, in this southern hill country, we have the highest point south of Baal HaTzor, but still not quite as high. Then the hill country falls rapidly away. Beersheba is almost exactly in the middle of the area that the biblical material refers to as the Negev, although in modern usage, the term Negev is used to cover a much broader, a much wider geographical area. And then to the south, about 25 kilometers or so south of Beersheba, is the site of Kadesh Barnea, which is an important site in the pre-conquest traditions concerning the period after the Hebrews departed Sinai onwards, according to the main storyline of the biblical tradition. Climbing out of the Jordan Valley, as you know, you climb very rapidly onto the hills on this side of the river, and the Adullam Mountains here are almost as high as the Galilee, well, they're higher, in fact, aren't they, than the Galilee Mountains, slightly. This is the Jordanian counterpart in terms of topography of the Galilean Islands to the west of the river. But the as you know, the tillable, the farmable area west of, or east of the river is very narrow indeed. So what I would like to do is show a series of slides, first illustrating the length of the Great Rift, and then the Transjordan, the various regions of the Transjordan, and we'll insert the divisions of the ancient claims of the ancient kingdoms here, and we'll do the same for the West Jordan Rift.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
what, or is there a name for that whole chain of mountains? And on the East Coast, we have the Appalachians in the States, and on the West Coast, we have the Rocky Mountain chain, whatever it's called at whatever point. Is there one name that is applied to that? That whole mountain?
This whole mountain range here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there a name for it?
I don't know.
Yes, there are. As the Moab Mountains and the...
Yeah, we refer to the Ajalin Mountains and the Moab Mountains.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But not one name.
But not one name for the continuous formation.
No.
Not that I know of. I've never heard one.
The next question is, does this rift continue on into what? Or continue on into the East African rift?
Yes, it does. It's part rift. Of the same geological formation, the same great... geological fault line.
What is it? It's an earthquake or an earthquake fault line across the rift?
I'm not much of a geologist, but it has to do with the shifting of plates, I think. Mm-hmm. Geological plates, rather than volcanic activity. Although there is clear evidence of volcanic activity far in the past, not within historical times, so far as I know, but far in the past, in northern Saudi Arabia, the area which is referred to in the biblical traditions, almost certainly, I think, as the land of Midian. And we'll have more to say about that later on. So, the biblical tradition claimed the land from Dan in the far north, at the lower slopes of the formation which leads up to Mount Hermon, snow-capped year-round. We'll see that a little later on. Tell Dan, I think I'm standing on the Tell, in fact, and taking a picture of what at that time was no man's land. From Dan to Beersheba in the south, scarcely 150 miles as the crow flies. One of the things that I had really to get used to is the short distances over here. And Beersheba is almost exactly the center of what the biblical tradition referred to as the Negev of ancient Israel. Now, there's Hermon in the far north. This is taken, this is a site called Tel Aviv, far to the north in that panhandle that goes up on the other side. One of the streams, which is the headwaters of the Jordan River, emerges right at Tel Dan and becomes the stream which empties into the Lake of Tiberias from the north, and then this is more familiar to you as the Jordan River flowing south from the Lake of Tiberias and the Sea of Galilee. Actually, we're looking north, as I understand it, in this picture. And this is looking north, also along our side of the rift. It's the eastern half, our side of the Jordan River Valley that has that, because it was out of the rain shadow, has always been more productive, and really the breadbasket one of the major breadbaskets of the entire corridor, the major tells from the Middle Bronze and Late Bronze and Iron Age in the valley are all on this side with one exception, and that's Jericho on the other side. This is the series of, I have included simply four of these tells from the southern half of the Jordan River rift. This is Tel Sa'adiyah at the mouth of the Wadi Kufunje. Tel Mazar, currently under excavation. Tel Deir Ala, which many of you have visited. And Tel Damiyah. These towns are all concentrated in the lower half of the Jordan Valley, in contrast to one site only of major proportions of the other side, and that because it arose near the well-watered oasis of Ain, well-watered by Ain HaSatan. This is the other side of the Rift Valley, now the Rift, the Jordan River Rift. Now looking south, this is the oasis of Jericho. That's Tell us the town, looking like the surface of the moon after many decades of excavation, which has turned up no evidence of a late Bronze Age city, as many of you know. And so one of the questions which, and the question with which we will concern ourselves a good part of next week is, how's come the book of Joshua spends six chapters getting ready to attack a city which wasn't even in existence as a city at the end of the Late Bronze Age. But that's for next week. Continuing on to the south, just a few miles south of Jericho, is the Wadi Qumran coming down to the Dead Sea. And on the brink of the Wadi, the site of the famous settlement related to the caves in which the famous Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. Continuing on about far more than midway down the other side of the Dead Sea is the site of Masada, directly opposite the Lisan Terrace, which emerges from the other side. This is the area that is known in the biblical traditions as the wilderness of Judah. It's the area in the rain shadow, and therefore very desolate most of the year. South of the Dead Sea, which as we said is some 1,200 feet or more below sea level, the terrain begins to rise gradually. As you go down the Arabah here, we're looking out into the Arabah from the southern hills of Jordan. The terrain begins to rise gradually. Here's a ground level shot of the Arabah, again from our side, until at the Gulf, we're once again at sea level. But just before we get there, on the other side, we come to a region of ancient copper mining and copper smelting activity. The area known now as Timnah, and just around the other side of these boulders is the site of a late Bronze Age, 13th century, temple to the Egyptian goddess Hathor, which was also worked by people, which was worked by people who left behind them there many examples of a very distinctive pottery, which has been traced, its production has been traced to a few clay deposits and a large urban settlement in northern Saudi Arabia called Quraya, not very far south of the Jordan Saudi border. That's right in the heart of the region which, to which the biblical tradition seems to point under the name of Midian. And so this distinctive pottery has been dubbed Midianite pottery. There is a problem about dipping into the Bible for names of pottery types, which may seem to prejudge the historical configuration which produced the pottery and so forth. But in any case, that's what it's called. It turned up here in great quantities. And this has turned out to be a very important site for theories about the emergence of ancient Israel in the land on both sides of the river. Come back in about a week or two and we'll talk more about that. Continuing on south, we get finally to the Gulf looking in this view across from Eilat to Aqaba, and in this one from Aqaba back to Eilat and to the mountains of northern Sinai. And this is a view of the Sinai a little farther down the coast. And not far to the south of Eilat is the island Jezirat Faraun, atop which sits a castle, a fortification, built not a crusader castle, as I understand it, but probably built by one of the Arab rulers in the process of fending off or driving out crusaders. Now, back to a map which shows the distribution of the tribal claims as they are described in the last part of the book of Joshua. I put a very sketchy outline of the contents of these two books, Joshua and Judges, on the board here. Can you see it? No. Yes, you might. The book of Joshua falls into two major parts. The first 12, the warfare stories are concentrated in the first 12 chapters. Chapters 13 to 21 describe the allotment of various segments of this turf to each of the tribes. Here's Manasseh straddling the river. Judah dominating the the largest portion in the south, Ephraim and Manasseh, the Galilee tribes, and so forth. Now, if I remember rightly, what I want to do next is simply go from north to south down this side of the river again, because here the major geographical division over here is the plain of Esdraelon, interrupting the Galilee Mountains, separating the Galilee Mountains from the mountains to the south. Over here, we have these tremendous deep wadis, one forming the Yarmouk, separating the area that was known as Bashan in antiquity, today Jalam, the Golan Heights, from the area which anciently was also known as Gilead before it was claimed for the tribe of Manasseh, or the area centering today in the Ashurim Mountains, between the Yarmouk and the Zarqa. The Zarqa flowing down here, forming a loop to pretty much include the ancient capital of Ammon, Rabbah Ammon, which is the Tell downtown here. And the next major wadi is the big Wadi Mujib, known anciently as the River Arnon. I've indicated these biblical names on the map there. The Yarmouk is not mentioned in the Old Testament, but it's probably referred to as the Yarmouk already in biblical times because it appears in some of the early historians in that name. The Zarqa was known as the Jabbok. The Arnon was known, or the Mujib was known as the Arnon, and the Wadi Hisa, probably the River Zered. And the original home, perhaps, of the Moabites is south of the Arnon, although we find them in the biblical tradition frequently in control of the regions to the north. And in fact, Hesbon, the excavator, is with us. Hesbon is the seat of Moabite power, location, or rather, a place called Heshbon, Heshbon in biblical material, is the center of Moonlight Power. And that name has seemed to survive in the name Miss Bond, Tatlas Bond. Larry's excavations have indicated that there was no Late Bronze Age city until Miss Bond. And so, but a large and very powerful Iron Age city there. Where was Late Bronze Age? Eshbon. Well, we'll see one site that is often proposed as a good candidate for Late Bronze Age, Eshbon, and that's the site of Jalul. But Moab's claims centered on the plateau south of the Wadi Arnon, but it is also clear that Moab from time to time exerted power to the north of that great canyon, and that this area, and the traditions make it quite clear that this is an area that was frequently contested between Kings Moab and Ammon to the south and Ammon to the north. This, the region to the south is the region of ancient Edom. Now, the traditions in Numbers 20 and following, according to the traditions, the main storyline, which we meet in Numbers 20 and following, and echoed at a number of points thereafter, is that the Israelites coming from Kadesh Barnea over here in the northern Sinai were refused permission by the king of Edom to pass through his land, and so they made a detour around the land and through or around Moab before encountering their first opposition and the first kind of battle stories, warfare stories for the emergence of Israel in Transjordan, center in this area of to the north of ancient Moab.
I'm sorry to ask you this question, but perhaps you dealt with it at the beginning. You've got Canaan up there on the board with Israel. But what exactly was the land of Canaan?
Canaan, it is not abundantly clear what was the land of Canaan. But it seems to have been the label for a covering label for the exercise of Egyptian sovereignty in the corridor between the desert and the sea. It so happens that most of the sites which are mentioned in the inscriptions of the pharaohs are to the west of the river. And the sites, most of the sites with very few exceptions, Pella is one significant exception, that are mentioned in the Amarna letters, are west of the river. So it is not clear to me whether the pharaohs of the 18th and 19th dynasty would have staked major claims west or east of the river, with exception possibly of places like Pella and some of those others down there in the Jordan Valley. In the biblical material, Canaan seems to refer mostly to the West Jordan region. Although, there are tensions, there are problems.
And the Philistines?
And the Philistines. I didn't talk about them. Let me back up to the map here. The Philistines appear on the scene about the same time or not long after the events which find Israel and these other peoples in competition for the land. They are one of a number of peoples who are named in documents of the 19th dynasty? Yeah. In Egypt. In which Pharaoh Seti complains that about having had to do with invasions of various peoples, among whom are a people called Pileshet, Philistines. These sea peoples are peoples who are apparently turning up in this part of the world as a result of the collapse, the breakup of international relations in the period of Ramses the Great, at the time in the wake of the face-off between the Egyptians and the Hittites. Marauders, pirate bands, all kinds of small but powerful opportunist groups. They are defeated by Pharaoh, we are told, but he nonetheless makes a virtue of necessity and allows them to settle in the southern coastal plain. So the southern coastal plain, and there are a group of five which become particularly famous. It's famous for the so-called Philistine Pentapolis. Ashdod, Ashkelon, Ekron, Gath, Gaza.
And the Cretans next.
Yes, they are one of the they are one of the sea peoples. Caribites. They produce a distinctive pottery, which has turned up not only in the cities, those five cities and a number of other sites in the southern coastal plain, but also foreign land and sites in the Esdraelon Valley, and more recently, and most surprisingly, at Deir Alla. So, and they are the people whose competition with another incoming group called Israel beyond the crisis, which according to the, again, Sylvanian storyline, results in the establishment of a monarchy, a highly centralized governmental system early in the, at the turn of the end of the 11th, beginning of the 10th century BC. So by about the year 1020 BC, the same piece of turf, what could be considered Canaanite, Philistine, or Israelite, depending on one's ultimate loyalties. Or it could be considered Moabite or Israelite. You begin to get a picture of a very tumultuous time during the breakdown of the treaties which had maintained a semblance of a balance of power and stability. The period which James Henry Dresden called the end of the first great internationalism in the ancient Near East. It was in that period in which, for the first time, nation states emerged in Transjordan, that is, wide-ranging nation states, instead of these divine right monarchs, highly unified, wide-ranging nation-states emerged west of the river, and this organization called Israel, east of the river, and this organization called Israel, west of the river. Now, let's look at some, very quickly, this short portion of historical geography is taking too long. Here's the Yarmouk, looking across from the other side, from the side of the Belvoir Castle. Here's the Yarmouk Valley emptying into the Jordan River. This is the Golan Heights to the north. We're coming into to the mountains of Gilead. Farther to the south, the Absalom Mountains. Here we are in the Golan Heights. And much to my surprise, we came upon Birkat Ram, way up here in the heights. I'd never known that the place existed, never heard of it. But a very nice lake.
The natural lake?
It's a natural lake, high up in the small. Here's an aerial view of the Yarmouk. These are the Golan Heights. This is occupied territory to the north. We're not, at this point, we're not far from Unkes. We were talking earlier about a visit to somebody, to our visit to Unkes. Here we're looking in the opposite direction at the Yarmouk Basin. This is the Lake of Tiberias. These are the Galilee Mountains. That's the west of the land over here, the beginning of the Gilead Mountains. Again, from the site of Belvoir, looking across toward the Yarmouk Canyon. This is the Jordan River winding through here. At this point, quite a bit of tillable land this side of the river, but not nearly as wide as the region on our side. These are the Ajalim Mountains corresponding on this side to the Galilee Mountains on the other side in terms of comparable geographical regions. The site of Tel Hussein, one of the largest, richest, potentially richest unexcavated sites, one of the most desirable sites yet to be
Is that near Hussein Village?
Yeah, very near Hussein Village, yes. And the road from Amman to Irbid to Littleland goes wetter.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's inside 300 families on Tel Hussein. That's probably why it would never be excavated.
And maybe how far east of Irbid? 10 miles to 10 miles? To Tel Aramaic, about midway between here and you're in the edge of the desert already at Tel Aramaic, probably the site of Ramoth in Gilead, one of the most powerful cities in Gilead in the early in the Iron Age, and figures prominently in the stories of Samuel and so on. The Zirka River, the Ajalim Mountains to the north. Amman is maybe right under our airplane at this point, looking out at the Jordan Rift Valley.
The Talal Reservoir Dam right there.
Should be, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Here's the Tel downtown. Tel Safut, Safut or Sahab?
Sahab.
Sahab, I'm sorry. Just what, 12 kilometers or so southeast from here. Again, very close to the desert. Tel Hispan. There was no Late Bronze Age city here, or it was the city that figured in the genesis of those traditions regarding opposition to the Israelite advance through this part of the country. Well, at least one of the highly respected archaeologists, whose initials are James Sauer, once suggested to me that it may well have been Jalur, which is almost due east, maybe about 10, 12 kilometers.